7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello, John.
Hello, Todd. It's another episode of Flight Safety Detectives, and today we have a special guest.
Yes, we do.
I'll let you carry the ball and introduce our guest, and let's get into it. Fascinating story.
Today we have a very special guest, flight surgeon, former NASA flight surgeon and Air Force flight surgeon, Dr. Gregory Rogers, who, among other things, and he has quite the resume, was a flight surgeon for 31 shuttle missions and I believe 15 shuttle landings. So you were involved.
I think 14 landings.
And this was in the 89 to 1995 timeframe. And you saw quite a bit of what the operations were like there, as well as having prior experience as a military flight surgeon, where you were actually, as you can tell from the jacket, those of you who have very, very sharp eyes, you can see that he has a senior flight surgeon set of wings there. And as he was telling us right before the show, there are three kinds of ratings in the Air Force: pilot, navigator, and flight surgeon. And that badge that you're wearing means that you had, what, something on the order of 800 hours at least of experience flying?
Yeah, you have to have that to become a senior flight surgeon, but I ended up with nearly 1,000 hours between rotary wing and fixed wing.
And you're sort of bearing the lead there. You flew multiple kinds of vehicles, rotary wing and supersonic aircraft and subsonic aircraft. So you have more of a eclectic background in aviation than most pilots.
Well, all of that's true. I even drove a nuclear submarine underwater, but that's a whole other story.
How can you possibly top that? But wait, later on in the show, you probably will. But what I really want to get to is your experience in aerospace, within the space aspect of it, had some unique aspects to it in that you're a flight surgeon and the average person, even the average person in aviation think, well, a flight surgeon does medical things. But you are actually intimately involved with developing procedures to enhance the safety of the crew that went beyond the typical flight surgeon things that you do. For example, and this seemed pretty obvious to me, but not so obvious to NASA, something as simple as, gee, if the astronauts have to bail out or the ditch in the water, how can you see them at night? You might think, let's use some glow sticks. But there was a little disagreement between you and NASA over what color glow sticks you should use. So run it by me for a minute. Why was NASA so wrong?
Okay.
So right.
Well, a lot of NASA managers wanted to do stuff without Air Force input to show that, hey, we're NASA. We don't have to listen to the Air Force. For instance, when they were switching from the old-time spacesuits to the new ones, they decided to do it without rescue people's input. So they designed these beautiful blue spacesuits that they would wear. And they didn't show them to the rescue forces until it was just a few weeks before the mission where they were going to launch them. Well, as soon as the rescue people looked at him, they said, "You got to be crazy. Those are blue flight suits. When they go into the ocean, how are we going to see them?" So they ended up saying, "Oh, yeah, we can't use these." So if you go back and look at the crew pictures for the first four, maybe six space shuttle missions, the astronaut crews were wearing yellow spacesuits that they had to go get from Beale Air Force Base, because those were the U-2 SR-71 yellow suits. Because when they went in the water, you could see yellow. But with the blue suits that they designed, you couldn't see them. So this is just the kind of mentality problems that arise when you have people making decisions that really don't know what they're talking about. So when I arrived in 89, one of the things that really surprised me was then in the right lower leg pocket of the launch entry suit, or LES, they had two chem lights. And if the astronauts bailed out into the Atlantic Ocean at night, they were supposed to break these chem lights, hold them up, and wave them to us so that we could spot them from our helicopters at night and save them. The only problem was they were red chem lights, and the red chem lights can only be seen from close up. On the other hand, if you use green chem lights, and we had night vision goggles on a clear night, we could see them for 5 miles. And so as I started arguing with the people from NASA, they said, "Yeah, but red is going to protect their night vision." And I said, "Look, I don't care about that. The green chem lights are not going to ruin their night vision. But the main important thing is I care about what I can see. My crew is supposed to go save them. If they don't have colors that we can see with our night vision goggles, my crew cannot rescue the astronauts. We first have to find them before we can rescue them. So we've got to have the green chem lights." And it took a year and a half to get them to switch to the green chem lights. So if they landed in the ocean, they could hold up the green chem lights. And with our night vision goggles, we could spot them and say, "Hey, there they are. Let's go save their lives."
So by what you were describing, it sounds as though when there was a mission, you weren't just sitting in an office watching TV. You were standing by ready to jump into a helicopter and go get them.
Oh, yes. We had three HH-3 helicopters that were prepared for each space shuttle launch and each landing operation at Kennedy Space Center. These were the big Jolly Green Giant helicopters. And so we had to, first of all, clear the box, which meant that we would go downrange from the launch site and make sure that aircraft and surface vessels were out of the way, because when they launched, the solid rocket boosters are going to fall. And if there's somebody out there, it could fall and hit their ship, and then, you know, that would be disastrous. So we first of all had to clear the box, make sure that everything was good. Some of the times when we had Department of Defense or CIA satellites that we were launching, these funny trawlers with Russian flags happened to come into the area. So we had to make sure that they were gone. Once we cleared the box, we would go land at the shuttle landing facility and await 3 miles away in case there were any contingency operations. There were four contingency modes for while they were on the launch pad. The first one was if we just had to sweep in, the astronauts were out of the vehicle, and so we just picked up the astronauts and cleared them out of there. The second scenario, mode two, was if the closeout crew was there and whatever happened meant that we would have to recover not only the astronauts, but also the closeout crew. Then if it was such a situation where the closeout crew was out, but some rescue people had gone in there, we would have had to do a mode three, which included the astronauts and the rescue forces. And then the mode four meant that the astronauts were there, the closeout crew was there, and the safety people were there. So we would have to swoop in, pick up all of them and get them out of there, hopefully before the space shuttle blew up. So those were the four on the launch pad scenarios that we had. There were also four other modes that would happen after a launch attempt. The first one was called RTLS, or return to launch site. So if they had gone, say, 3.5 minutes up after launch and something went wrong, they could drop the external tank. And by this time, the solid rocket boosters would have burnt out and been separated. Until the SRB is separated, there's no contingency modes. You can't do anything to save them. But at 2 minutes and 5 seconds, the SRBs fall off. And so the crew could sort of turn the space shuttle orbiter around and still have enough energy stored within the system so that they could glide back to the shuttle landing facility and land safely. So that was mode five. A mode six would be if they attempted to do this, but when they got to the landing field on the shuttle landing facility, they had some sort of a mishap. Now then, if they were trying to get back to the shuttle landing facility and couldn't make it, and so they crashed like 3 miles away from the landing field, then that would be a mode seven. So we would have to swoop in, rescue the astronauts, provide treatment for whatever injuries they suffered, and get them out of there to some hospitals for definitive care. And then the most extensive one was a mode eight. In a mode eight, they couldn't get back to the shuttle landing facility, so they actually would have to bail out into the ocean. Now, depending on how far they had gone, their bailout could be 1,200 miles downrange. So we would have to get in our helicopters and be accompanied by C-130s who could refuel our helicopters. And so we would have to fly out to wherever they are and then go into a hover, pick them up out of the ocean, and then we would provide whatever medical care. You know, that's why me and my PJs were on the aircraft, and we had a flight surgeon and PJs on each of the three HH3 Jolly Green Giants so that we could pick up the entire crew, which usually comprised seven members. And then we would treat their wounds and get them to definitive care at one of the local hospitals.
And for the non-Air Force folks out there, when you hear PJs, you think pajamas, but no, in the Air Force, those are the pararescuemen, the folks who are especially trained.
Yeah, pararescue jumpers, but they're trained for a whole lot more than that. They're sort of the special operations people for the Air Force. One of the things that they do these days after what happened was that PJs were in Mogadishu when all of that went down. And so they actually had to run to escape for over a mile, even while they were carrying equipment and rescue people, and they had been in all these fights. And so when they go through PJ training now, one of the last things they do in their training cycle is they'll run the Mogadishu Mile, and it's in remembrance of what those guys had to do in Mogadishu during the Black Hawk Down episode.
Oh, I was about to say, when you're mentioning Mogadishu, you're actually talking about the story of Black Hawk Down, which, of course, got turned into a movie.
Yes. While they show Army Rangers and they show Delta Force, they don't mention the Air Force PJs, but they were there too. So the PJs deserve all the credit. I loved flying with the PJs. They were great people. I always tried to make sure that I trained my PJs for any contingency, And so the PJs that I had at Patrick were just very close to me, and I was close to them because if anything went wrong with those astronauts, we had to rescue them. But it was more than just that, because we also did rescues for anybody who needed search and rescue operations out in the Atlantic Ocean. So I don't know how many search and rescue missions we went out on, but it was a lot of them. In fact, we also deployed to South Florida after Miami and all of Southern Florida got hit by Hurricane Andrew. And so I ended up getting a Humanitarian Service Award, a Sikorsky Lifesaving Award, and an Air Medal for the work that I did. But I could not have done that without my flight crews and without my PJs. So everybody was working as a team. So, you know, I was usually flying in Jolly One, which was for the flight surgeon in charge. Also the aircraft commander for Jolly One was the commander for the Jolly flights. So that commander controlled all of what was happening on all three Jolly Green Giant helicopters. And so we did a lot of things to save people's lives. And there's a lot of stories that came with that. One of my favorite ones is that we were called out one day to go to a Chinese communist ship. And they said there was somebody aboard that needed urgent medical care. So, you know, okay, we'll go out there. They promised there was a helipad. So we flew out to their ship, saw the helipad. So we landed on it, and it didn't seem like any big deal. Just about that time, a bunch of guys, maybe 12 or 15 guys with AK-47s, rushed the helipad and circled us. So we're all looking at each other like, man, is this a setup? Are they going to shoot us? It turned out that they had one guy who was sick, and he ended up with appendicitis. And so we ended up taking him to a hospital in Melbourne, Florida, where he had the surgery and recovered. But those guys were there with AK-47s pointing at their own crew. If any of those Chinese communists had gotten aboard our helicopter, they could ask for political asylum. So to prevent any of them having the opportunity to do that, they were willing to shoot their people down right in front of us.
But for the first 10 seconds or so, you weren't quite sure what was going on.
Oh, no, man. We were saying, wow, should we take off? Well, I don't know. You know, if they've got 15 AK-47s, they could put a lot of bullets into our aircraft. And then all of a sudden, we see that they formed a circle, but they are aiming out. They were aiming at their own sailors.
Wow.
So that puts things into perspective for you.
Well, you give me a perfect opportunity to segue into a different subject. The somewhat contentious relationship between NASA and the NTSB when it comes to safety in spaceflight. Now, during your time there, did you have much in the way of interactions with the NTSB as far as planning for contingencies?
No, because as far as I could tell from NASA, the NTSB didn't even exist. In all of our planning, we dealt with the Department of Defense through DDMS, and then we worked for all of the rescue people, the people who performed security service. But a lot of these guys were contractors and not actually active duty military, but contractors hired by NASA on the Kennedy Space Center side and hired by the Air Force on the Cape Canaveral side. But whenever I dealt with all of the guys doing all the plannings, and there were three training manuals in the STS transportation program to teach military flight surgeons how to support space shuttle operations. And so I wrote the one for the TAL sites, the Transocean Nickel-Port landing sites, and then also the one for support at Kennedy Space Center. And so I wrote both of those documents, and at no time did I ever hear the NTSB even mentioned.
So, John, did you ever get the feeling that NASA thought that you guys didn't exist?
Oh, they wanted us not to exist because basically the NTSB rules sooner or later everything we do is public. So we can hold certain things for a while, but the reports come out a year or two later, and everything that we did is in those reports. And all the documents that were reviewed, very rarely do government documents get redacted. So it was, everything was out in the open. And NASA certainly didn't want that, you know, and I think it came as a result of TWA 800, when we had all the problems with the FBI, and the FBI had a lot of problems with other agencies, not just us. And Congress finally sat down and made us all hang out MOUs. And on the NASA side, and if my memory serves me right, anything that occurred below 200,000 feet would be covered by the NTSB. And all the training flights that NASA does with their pilots, that fleet of F-5s that they fly around, if they had a mishap with that, that would have been investigated by the NTSB. And the fear at that time was, the talking to that I got at that time from NASA was that astronauts are national heroes. We don't want to paint them as being pilots that made mistakes. And, you know, I just shook my head with that. But that actually happened, that they weren't happy with the NTSB and our processes to come in. And of course, they had some experience with us with both of the shuttle accidents, because we had to put them back together. And that is a special expertise that doesn't exist in very many places. You know, if you go compare that Lockerbie accident over in the UK and how long they took to put together what they had, and it was only a fraction of what TWA had. So we had a bunch of people that were very, very good at putting the puzzles back together again. And NASA couldn't do it, and Boeing can't do it on the commercial side. And we just had a team of people that was very, very good at being able to piece these things back together again.
NASA has a global reputation, and not just the astronauts, but the organization as a whole. And in my opinion, they do a lot to keep up that reputation. One of the good things they did when I was a kid, I was some junior high school kid, barely out of elementary school, in fact. I decided one day to write to the public affairs office. This was like in the very early 70s. I asked them for things about, you know, the moon flights and everything. They sent me tons of stuff. Every time I wrote, it's like, oh my God, I got like full mission reports and everything. So their office was very good, at least impressing me that they were a great organization. However, they are an organization of human beings. And Greg, you told me a story earlier about a mishap, not a fatal one, but one where, let's just say that the write-up didn't really reflect the facts. So I'll just let you take it from there.
Okay. Yeah, well, NASA was really bad about that. They didn't even want to give the Air Force credit for anything. When they would land at Edwards Air Force Base, which was this great big area with flat surface, so that if they missed one runway, it didn't matter. It's a dry lake bed. You're going to eventually come to a stop in a safe position. NASA would never admit that they were landing at Edwards Air Force Base. According to NASA documents, they were landing at Dryden Flight Research Facility, which was a small set of buildings on Edwards Air Force Base. But Dryden Flight Research Facility owned no runways. So they landed on Edwards Air Force Base, but they would always say, we're landing at Dryden. So NASA wants to take credit for everything. Well, the thing is, the story I'm about to tell you is one that they didn't want to take credit for. They were working on the orbiter Atlantis, and they needed to get to, I believe it was the center, Space Shuttle Main Engine, or SSME. And so to get there, they had to put an 8-foot I-beam in so that they could crawl across and get to that engine to perform their work. Then at the end of it, you've got to take the I-beam out. So NASA is crazy about safety and redundancy. So both of those men ended up signing a document that said, I took out the I-beam and it is no longer in the orbiter. There were two observers who were assigned to watch those two workers. So those observers documented on their paperwork, yes, the two of us saw the two of them carry out the I-beam. Then there were three safety guys that were monitoring the observers who were observing the workers. And the three of them all said, we saw those two guys watch the other two guys when they took out the I-beam. And then they had two senior safety guys who oversaw the three safety guys who observed the two observers and the two workers. And they also wrote, yes, we watched those three guys, watched those two guys that watched those two guys who took the I-beam out. So every one of these on paper documented all of this stuff. Well, they took Atlantis into the vehicle assembly building. And because it was built for the Apollo days, the support beams going up 52 stories through there did not have enough space for the orbiter to go through with its wings being as wide as they were. So what they would do is they would bring this claw down and they would attach it to the orbiter. Then they would tilt it up and rotate it. And then in that fashion, they could slide it through the two main supports for the building, drop it down, and then mate it to the external tank, which was already attached to the two solid rocket boosters. And then once the entire shuttle assembly was prepared, they would roll it out on the crawler to the launch site. Well, when they lifted up Atlantis in this way, they heard something banging around in there. And so, you know, it was kind of shaking. And they said, hey, something's wrong. Set it back down. So they set it back down and they took it back to the orbiter processing facility to find out what it was. So when they opened the aft compartment, that 8-foot I-beam was still in there. So when they lifted it up, it fell from its location, banging stuff on the way, doing a bunch of damage. And so NASA did not want to admit, hey, we left an I-beam in there and we really screwed it up. So they said that some repairs would be needed because of a vibroacoustic anomaly. Well, it vibrated as the I-beam hit things and it made a noise. So it was a vibroacoustic anomaly, but because it was rated that and not a mistake by the crew, the company that was the contractor responsible for that did not get fined by NASA. But NASA also didn't have to admit the mistake they'd made. So they called it a vibroacoustic anomaly and just pressed on.
As you may know, John's had a couple of years in the maintenance business. So, John, have you ever heard of anything like this?
Yeah, I have. It happens everywhere, really. And it's really a failure to follow procedures. It's pretty basic, but it does happen, you know, especially when you get behind, you know, and they take somebody's word for it that they took it out. So in this case, I would say they probably took the word of the second group, not the original guys, because they would have probably owned up that they didn't take it out yet. They had something else to do when they didn't get back to it. But it's not uncommon. But it just shows a culture issue within the organization.
Absolutely. They were more worried about the paperwork than they were making sure the I-beam got out. And so even when they found out that the I-beam had been left in, they still sort of covered it up by calling it a vibroacoustic anomaly.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the most challenging calls that you have had?
The most challenging calls that we can get here are senior pilots that aren't qualified, that haven't flown 25 hours or more in the last 12 months, and they don't meet our underwriting guidelines. And so those can be very challenging because you feel for them, but at the same time, you have to abide by our guideline.
And so are they always trying to, you know, finesse you and go, well, but I will, or I did, or, I mean, what do you require for them to prove that they've either flown those 25 hours or will fly those 25 hours for your underwriting?
Well, they tell us, you know, we take their word of mouth. So they tell us we're going to trust them. We're going to believe them. You know, they're going to have current flight review, valid medicals, you know, at least 25 hours. And then there's some that don't have it. They go get it. They call back.
What about the funniest phone call you've ever had where you just started laughing because the information that you got is like, there's just no way I could do anything for this person?
Well, I had a guy that called in one time, and we have basic questions that we ask. Have you had any accidents? Have you had any incidents or claims, DUIs, arrests? And when I asked that question, he said, well, yes, I used my plane to smuggle cocaine back in 1988. And I got real quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And I said, are you serious? And he said, no, I'm just messing with you. It's freaking.
So, Judd, to write him?
I think we quoted him, but if we were too high, I can't remember the place. It was a few years ago.
Yeah, well, carrying that kind of cargo, I can imagine the premium was real high.
He caught me off guard. I was like, some people are brutally honest, and some people just like to pull your list. So yeah. At the end of the day, it was fun.
Can they still get insurance if they had a minor landing accident?
Yes, they certainly can. As long as it's outside 36 months, we'll take a look at everything. And
do you require them to demonstrate that they've either had recurrent training after their incident or accident? Is there any criteria? You know, because a lot of times, you know, if the FAA doesn't require a 709 ride, just a, you know, refresher or check ride, do you all require that before you'll underwrite somebody that had an incident or an accident?
We don't require you, but there's some people that do it, you know, and they'll call back and they're like, hey, I got 20 hours of dual, you know, I'm ready to go, and we'll re-underwrite it and we'll offer coverage because that is a great thing to say.
Great. How long have you been here, Justin?
About 5 years.
And what's the best part of your job?
The best part of the job is being able to travel, to go to air shows like Oshkosh, Sun and Fun, being able to meet our customers, you know, face-to-face, give them free things. You know, I'm always taking money from them. It's nice to be able to get them something, you know.
Yeah, well, that's
other free little good.
Yeah, there's a good tagline. When was the last time your insurance company gave you something other than a bill?
You know, so we try to do things. But it's fun to do that.
You got a hat.
It's fun to go to those shows because you get to meet the customers, and when you meet them face to face, it's just like you've known them for a long time, and then you establish those connections over years, and they call back and, hey, I remember you.
And now back to the flight safety detectives.
Now, another thing this reminds me of that you told me earlier, a different kind of cover up in a sense. The fact that during the shuttle program for a number of years, well before Columbia, that there were issues with tiles coming loose or being knocked off during launch, and yet there were ways that they could have found out about this but didn't use them in some cases. But more to the point, which is getting to what I wanted to get to, you wrote a book called Impact, which was a fictionalized NASA emergency situation where, because of malfunctions of the shuttle, they were in, you know, at risk of not coming back alive. This was written in the mid-90s, and this was
in— Yes, I wrote it in 93 and published it in 95.
This is partly due to your experience working with the organization, trying to get on board the shuttles, their repair kit, because it was known that shuttle tiles coming loose or being knocked off by ice or whatnot was a problem. It was known that the possibility existed there would be damage in orbit that could be repaired by the astronauts if they had the tools, yet NASA did not want to put the tools up there. What was their argument?
Well, every pound on the space shuttle is important. Well, if you put more stuff on, that would mean you would have to take other stuff off. So they did not view it as enough of a safety issue to spend the weight to put all of the repair kit onto the shuttle orbiter, so that if there were damaged tiles, or in the case of Columbia, they had an 18-inch hole in the leading edge of the reinforced carbon-carbon on the left wing. Well, there was no repair kit. Now then, when Columbia was up in space, the United States has all kinds of assets that could have taken photos of that left wing and checked to see how bad the hole was. But the problem for NASA is, even if you identify the hole, they didn't have a repair kit up. So they just sort of hoped that, like many other shuttle missions before that, that even though there were damaged tiles, they'll make it back okay. You know, I believe you had Hoot Gibson on your show. Anybody that gets Hoot Gibson talking about one of his missions and all of the damaged tiles they had, he will tell you exactly what he thought of it. But I won't speak for him, but he's been very outspoken about his attitude toward the fact that they were putting their lives at risk for damages to the thermal protection system that they couldn't repair. And so I ended up having a book signing with Buzz Aldrin. I had a book signing with Jim Lovell Jr. There were people in the program who knew exactly what I was talking about. There's a group called LOEC, which is Loss of Orbiter Entry Capability. And that's at Johnson Space Center, which means, hey, if the space shuttle is damaged and we can't get them down, what can we do? Well, one of the guys from the LOEC, when I was doing my book signing at Space Center Houston, came to me and said, Major Rogers, I'll tell you right now, the story you put in your novel is our worst nightmare. If we lose another crew, it's probably going to be damaged to the thermal protection system, just like you wrote in your book. And then 8 years later, we lost Columbia because there was a hole in the leading edge of the left wing, and they did not repair it, and it caused the orbiter to disrupt during entry procedures, and the crew was lost.
Yeah, remember that well, actually.
It tore me up. It absolutely tore me up because I had told them 8 years beforehand, you did this. But I wasn't the only one doing this. There were lots of safety people throughout NASA, the Air Force, and everybody that was telling them, you've got to protect the thermal protection system better than what you're doing, because we're going to lose a crew from this. And so it wasn't just me, but I was the one that wrote the book. But there were lots of other people saying the same thing. And we ended up losing that crew because of damage to the thermal protection system, when a very simple repair could have saved them. But that repair was not available.
You know, and all those pieces, if I remember right, the vehicle started to come apart over Hawaii. And the pieces started to fall off of it as it came down. And we have a couple of individuals at the NTSB that are unbelievable with doing the math to predict where you find those pieces. And they were predicting that NASA needed to go look in New Mexico, eastern Arizona, and mostly in New Mexico. And everybody thought they were nuts. But when they couldn't find them, then they finally went over to New Mexico, where, in the area where we said they were, they found them.
Well, the vehicle began to deteriorate as soon as they started through the entry procedure. The leading edge of the wing is protected by reinforced carbon-carbon, which is supposed to be safe up to 2300 degrees. Well, it's only safe to 2300 degrees if it's intact, but there was a hole in it, and that hole allowed that 2300 degree temperature fire plasma to get into the left wing and start burning through the metal structures. You know, they lost the pressure in the left landing gear. There were all kinds of sensors that were going offline. It was because a blowtorch was inside that wing melting everything. And eventually it lost enough structural integrity that the wing broke apart, and there goes the whole ballgame.
And as some of you might recall, there was debris not just in New Mexico, but all over Texas and into Louisiana, which was by far the most extensive debris pattern from any aerospace accident ever.
Well, normally, you're not flying Mach 25. The space shuttle re-enters at Mach 25. So 25 times the speed of sound. You know, while they're on orbit, they're moving 5 miles per second. That's how fast they're traveling. They will circle the Earth in 90 minutes. In 90 minutes, they will see a sunrise and a sunset. So that in one 24-hour period, they'll see 18 sunrises and sunsets. That's how fast they're traveling.
Now, before we run out of time, there's one area which I wanted to talk about. That is, not only were you a flight surgeon involved in redesigning procedures, you've also, for years, given lectures on accident investigation, dealing with witnesses, and a subject that we've talked about here indirectly, witnesses for UAP events, which could be any number of things from natural phenomena that's unfamiliar to exotic machines, et cetera, et cetera. And the approach you take is sort of the approach that we're trying to take here. Treat this as an aviation safety issue. How do you investigate a sighting of something unusual? And how do you do so in a way that keeps the data from being compromised?
Well, one of the first things we had to do for this situation was I had to get clearance to even speak about it. So I contacted the commander of the Navy's Professional Development Symposium in November of 2023 and said, look, I'm going to talk in April, just like I have for the last 5 years. I would like to talk about human factors in aviation identification of military drones, but I would also like to speak to unexplained aerial phenomena, otherwise known as UFOs. The Navy has released video from the cockpits of F-18s and declassified that and showed it to Congress, and the pilots have spoken about it. Since the Navy has done this, and this will be a Navy symposium, even though it's for everyone in the DOD, can I speak about it? So we went back and forth with several emails and finally said, well, if you do it in a professional manner that we approve of, we'll let you do that. So I ended up making my slide set, and then I sent it to them for review, and they reviewed it and said, yes, we give you permission to present your slide pack as it is. Then just to make sure, I contacted the public affairs officer at McAllister Army Ammunition Plant, which was where I was working, which I'm still proud to say I spent 14 years there, because if people look at current or recent events, I cannot confirm or deny what we built or didn't build out there, but I'm proud of what our guys did, guys and gals. So I sort of lost track of where I was at. Oh, so I got approval by the public affairs officer at McAllister Army Ammunition Plant, and just to make sure, I sent a copy of the slides over to Fort Sill, which was the bigger Army base that oversaw what we were doing. And the public affairs officer there also gave written permission for me to give this lecture. So in April of 24, I lectured on things like visual illusions, different kinds of aspects of identifying what has happened based on the directions and instructions for what the rescue crews were supposed to do, what the witnesses saw, and how to get information from them. And then for the last 15 minutes, I addressed the situation with UAPs. And so I said, these things are real. When you look at the, especially the videos of the F-18s, you know, you can see that these are vehicles that can outperform anything that we own. So they're anomalous, not just because of what they look like, but because of what they do. And so then I discussed, here's what we need to learn from people. If you interview witnesses who have seen either an aircraft mishap or a UAP event. So I ended up giving that lecture, and I ended up like 2 weeks later getting a letter from the commander who had authorized me to give that lecture. And he wrote a letter thanking me for giving that presentation. And it was very well received. The military people who were watching, and they videotaped it and made it available so that people who were not there at the time I gave it could also review the lecture. And I just got all positive comments because the military people, a lot of them know stories. They may not be able to tell the stories, but they know all of those stories. So it was extremely well received, and it was sort of the preparation for what I was going to release. Once I retired, I knew the story about what I saw in 1992, and I knew I was going to tell it.
Let me interrupt for a moment and just give the audience a heads up. This is a story that you actually released, I believe, back in April. You had about a half-hour video.
I retired on April 30th, and it was released on May 4th.
And you gave a testimony, half-hour, uninterrupted, with you giving a very full story of an event that was not part of an official program that you're aware of, but you were exposed to it when you were in the military. And this is something which we'll link to in our show notes. But I introduced that because your interest in UAP predated what you were doing presentation-wise. And by the way, the presentation sounds fantastic. If there's any part of that which is releasable to the public, if you could share it with us, we will share it with our audience. And go ahead.
Everything that I put in that statement is releasable to the public. Even the lecture I gave in 2024 was not classified and had to be suitable for public release. So if somebody wants to do a Freedom of Information Act, they can get access to the lecture that I gave, because I could not provide any classified information in that lecture. I've also got the slides. I've got the slides, so I can reproduce that at any time. I can always talk.
Very good. Two innocent questions. This sounds like a fantastic briefing to be given to any military or flying organization. Do you think it would have been useful for NASA to have given this to their astronauts in the past, or to give this very lecture to the astronauts who are active duty right now?
Yes and no. The UAP phenomenon, officially by NASA, has never been identified. But unofficially, there are stories. They are stories that can't be told by the people who know them. But there are stories there. And just like NASA's not going to admit that they land at Edwards Air Force Base, and they're not going to meet the National Aviation Safety Board has any control over what they do. They're not going to tell these stories, but they have stories that if the people who witnessed those events came forward, there are lots of people who could tell stories much better than me, much better than the one I have. But, you know, as I mentioned, in the information that you're referring to, in 1992, I actually saw the video of a flying saucer being tested. But the question is, am I going to report this to anybody? Who on earth would I report it to, and what would happen to me if I reported it? And so at that time, I made the career decision of, I'm not telling nobody nothing about this thing. And so I didn't even tell my wife about it for 15 years. But once I was totally retired from the military, that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to tell what happened.
Then just to give a little spoiler alert here, this was not something you saw walking down the street one night. This was something that was being tested inside of a hangar with a vehicle that had test markings on it to sort of gauge how fast it was turning, that sort of thing. And also with U.S. Air Force logos and insignia on it. It was tethered to the ground, some sort of electrical tether or whatnot. It was giving extraordinary flight characteristics, even within a hangar.
Yes, it was. It showed one particular type of flight characteristic that no aircraft, rotary wing or fixed wing, that I ever flew could duplicate. So I'll just say it like that.
And I encourage everyone to, when you see the link in our show notes, by all means, go check it out. It'll be worth your time. And the other innocent question I was going to put out there is, this would be fantastic if the FAA would step forward and start putting out information like this in an advisory circular or something like that, to give people advice on how to interview witnesses who see something extraordinary, whether it looks like a UFO or whether it looks like a strange weather phenomenon or whatever. And John, you know, what kind of usefulness would that sort of training be for the NTSB and the current slate of investigators?
Well, we certainly would be interested, like many other agencies, in getting to know what's going on. You know, I have one accident that happened in the Gulf of Mexico, south of Tampa, involving a general aviation airplane. At night, the airplane went down under unknown circumstances. Radar, it was barely on radar. It was out quite a way out. Was barely on radar, no other radar hits, and the airplane just went down. And it was steep enough that we didn't have to go, we being the NTSB, did not have to go after it because it was too deep for scuba divers. One of the concerns that we have with airplanes that end up in relatively shallow water is that some of these divers want to be heroes and go down and recover something on, you know, the physical remains or something off these airplanes. So as long as they're deep enough, we don't go after them. And that one was deemed deep enough that we didn't need to go after it. But we got some congressional pressure, and we went after it and recovered the airplane and brought the airplane up, and we couldn't find anything abnormal about that airplane except paint that was like a paint scrape on the airplane. It was substantial. On the airplane. And so we had the paint analyzed, and what came back was it's like no paint that we've ever seen before. And we checked with a lot of the military down there, because there's a lot of military in that area. And of course, nobody had nothing missing, nothing was flying. You know, so there was the complete denial across the board. So we had no place to go. It remains open, I believe. It was for the longest time. I haven't followed it. But that was just one example of some of the strange things that are going on. And I've seen some of them myself. I'll tell you one, Todd, that I've not told very many people, that in the early 80s, I had the opportunity on a telephone call to talk to Frank Borman. He had called looking for somebody that I knew. I was there. I answered the phone. And while somebody else ran to get him to come to the phone, I had Borman on the phone. And I asked him about what he saw in the 60s when he said that he had a bogey around his spaceship. Reported a bogey. And they cut the communications off as soon as he reported it. And I asked him about that, and he gave me a circular answer that didn't tell me anything. So it's something new. UFOs are nothing new. They're out there.
And
Someday we'll find out.
a little bit about Frank Borman. I believe he did two flights. Apollo 8 was his last one. And he did it one Gemini flight. I believe those are the only two flights he was on. I'm not sure which bogey, one had the bogey on it.
Yeah, I had forgotten, but it was a long time ago. So like I said, that was in the early 80s. I had that conversation, and it was already old news. So it was, may have been the one in the 60s.
If everyone came forward with all of their stories, there would be a massive amount of evidence that would just be dumped on the American public. But they try to make it very difficult to tell these stories. So even though I saw that 33 years ago, there was no way I was going to talk about it until I was retired.
Again, in the 80s, I used to spend time riding off the road in California, in Arizona, on dirt bike. And one time at night, almost at night, looking up into the night sky, I saw this little dot, which was an airplane at high altitude, and it was making smoke donuts. And could never figure out what the hell that was. I never said that to anybody except the people that I was with. We all saw it. So this little dot was going through the air, and every once in a while, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, I forget what it was, there'd be a smoke donut behind it. The airplane was in the sun, and we were not so much in the sun, so the sun was settling. But it was clearly visible, these donuts, smoke donuts, behind this dot in the sky. And probably was 10 or 12 years later, when they came out with the engine that doesn't run constantly, it has thrust and then coast, thrust and coast, thrust and coast. And that's what I was looking at back in the early 80s.
I believe they call that the pulse detonation engine.
Yes, that's what it was. All right, so when you're around this country, our government has lots of programs that just nobody knows about. Nobody knows about and go around. In upstate New York, I can remember seeing helicopters, but I couldn't hear them. Never thought much of it because maybe the sound was going the other direction. It weren't that far away. And then come to find out years later that Sikorsky had a whole program up there on stealth helicopters and making the rotors quiet. You have U.S. government program that just was invisible to everybody. So we don't know what our government is into.
Well, given that we have a special guest today, we usually have the second to last word and last word. And I think, John, today you have the second to last word, and I'll just hand it off to you, Greg, to have the last word for the show.
And as usual, my last word is go if you're going to go flying, do a good job of pre-planning, do a great job of walking around on your airplane. And when you get in the air, put your head on a swivel because there's all sorts of stuff out there and you don't want to be running into anything.
And Greg, any last words for us? By the way, your words you've already said today, thank you for being here. The words you said
Oh,
back
you're very welcome.
in May.
I've enjoyed speaking to the two of you. There are people who have gone before Congress and stated that the United States has programs that were reverse engineering craft that were not of human origin. The craft I saw, I strongly believe, was a reverse engineering attempt for one of those craft. So I'll just leave it at that.
You know, and I don't believe it's new. You know, you still marvel at the moving of those huge stones on the pyramids. And we come up with all kinds of things. We floated them up. They rolled them up on logs. I mean, that's 4,000 years ago. And, you know, that all defies description. So I don't think this is a new phenomenon. I think if there is such a thing as being visited by other people with different technology, I think they've been visiting us for a long time.
I would agree.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, you're Sierra Oscar Lima. Vemco Insurance Company is the only direct writer in the market, never uses third-party agents or brokers. Instead, they connect you directly with real underwriters with real answers in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and approve coverage based on your flying. Floats to wheels and back to floats, Vemco gives you more flexibility. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit Vemco.com/flightsafety today. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.